Hi there, and welcome to IPIP Live, where I talk to members of the IPIP team and their partners about ways they can support you in making a positive impact on your organization's performance in practice. Across the series of podcasts, we will talk about a wide range of subjects, including organizational culture, facilitation, insights, and co-design, and getting policy and evidence into practice. Hello there, and welcome to this episode of IPIP Live, the Improving Performance in Practice podcast. I'm your host, Scott McInnes. It's lovely to be back. I think this might be our fifth episode. If you are a first-time listener, you are very, very welcome. Thanks for joining us. And if you are a returning listener, thanks a million for coming back. It just maybe shows that we've been doing something right in the previous episodes. So that's always nice. If you are either a new or returning listener, please do us a wee favor. If you wouldn't mind, give us a little five-star rating and a comment in whether you're a Spotify person, an Apple person, a Google podcast person, give us a little thumbs up, a little star and a wee comment. It really helps to get the news about the podcast out there. Today, you have the joy of not one Scott, but two Scots, because I am joined in the hosting chair, not physically, obviously, because he's in a different place, because that would be weird if we were sitting in the same chair. But I'm joined by Scott Mayer, who is the Director of Fatherhood Solutions at IPIP, who actually is a former guest on this podcast. And plainly, the team liked him so much that they said, come on, come in here and join us. So Scott, hello, how are you getting on?
Yeah, hi Scott, thanks for having me again. Yes, my name is Scott Mayer. I am Director of Fatherhood Solutions, who work, as it says, with fathers and people that work with them to include fathers in all aspects of parenting a little bit more. It comes from my experience of, if you don't know already, having seven boys and a granddaughter. So there's a bit of grey coming through on the chin that you won't see, but I put that down to being a grandparent. And the guest that we've got today, I won't introduce. But what I will say is, very big fan. I was fanboying for a while for Dan. Used his work in my workshops with dads, and used it as something that we could reference because it was visual. And then a tweet came out where he announced some news, which he'll be talking about today. And I thought, I'll give it a chance. My wife always says, if you don't ask, you don't get. So I dropped him a message and he replied, and we've been talking ever since. And yes, Scott, you can now introduce our esteemed guest.
Thank you very much. And actually, before we do that, I think we should just take a moment of silence to think about a house of seven boys.
It's not very silent very often, put it that way.
My God.
Yeah, there's a lot of testosterone. And as you pointed out before we started, it's raining. It's raining here as well, Scott. So there's no real getting out of the house. So we've got seven testosterone charged boys in the house today. So joy. Much of what I've learned from Dan is getting put in its place today. So,
well, listen, we've lifted the curtain very lightly on Dan. So today's guest that Scott and I will be chatting to is Dan Worry, who is the founder and president of Early Childhood Policy Solutions. And that's a public policy consultancy focused on the needs of young children and their families. And in our pre-chat, it was interesting because Dan is based in the US, as you will guess from his accent in a second. But I think a lot of what he'd been talking about in the US is as applicable in the UK, in Ireland, globally, as it is in the US. So we'll be getting more into that through the discussion. He's also an author who's recently published a new book called The Daycare Myth, What We Get Wrong About Early Care and Education and What We Should Do About It. And I wish to God I'd had that book 19 years ago. Dan, hello there. How are you getting on?
I'm doing well. It's great to be with you both.
Thank you very much.
And I thought you guys were the ones that had the accents.
We all suffer from, you know, me and the two Scots suffer from the slightly oddest Scottish accent on earth. Whereas at least you're a bit more straightforward in your accent, I'd suspect.
That could be. And you're welcome to call me Scott too today.
Excellent. The three Scots. That would get very confusing very quickly. Dan, listen, just to kick us off, what we always like to do is just give you an opportunity, just maybe to tell listeners, give us a quick 2-minute overview on you, on your career, and on the work that you do today.
Absolutely. I'm happy to. And thank you for the invitation to be here. I began my career actually in broadcast journalism, Scott, and worked in radio for a couple of years as a much younger guy, but actually have spent now 30 plus years at all different levels of early years work. I began in an after-school program, working with young kids while I was in graduate school, waiting to become a teacher. I taught kindergarten here in the public schools in the United States, was a school district administrator, so sort of the equivalent, I think, to your local councils. I live in the state of South Carolina, located on the eastern coast, the eastern seaboard of the United States. And so I was the deputy director and helped to lead the programs of the state's Early Childhood Education Agency for about 14 years. And then most recently began and sort of launched the early childhood policy work of a place called the Hunt Institute. It's located in Cary, North Carolina, a little bit to my north. And the Institute is the brainchild of Jim Hunt, who was the four-term governor of the state of North Carolina. And so I have, for the past 6 years or so, really traveled the country working with our state governors and local elected leaders, state lawmakers, on helping to craft high-quality early childhood policy across the U.S.
Super. Super. Thank you. That was great. And lovely to have you on equally. It was great. I loved our pre-chat, and I'm really looking forward to today's conversation. So that whole idea of early childhood, the early years of childhood development, what would you define what are those years? Is it kind of 0 to 4? Is it 4 to 9? And why are they so important? What is it about those particular years?
Yeah, you know, in the field, we think about the years of early childhood really as being sort of prenatal through age 8, typically as a definition for the field. A lot of my work, though, as I think you both know, has been very much for children 5 and under, and increasingly for children from prenatal to age 3, because we know that that is such a critical window in human development. It's the time, Scott, during which the fundamental architecture of the brain is wired in ways that will help to go on and, hopefully support our long-term success in school and in life. And so just a very, very consequential period. So the earlier, the better when it comes to thinking about getting things right for young kids.
Okay, interesting. And of course, it's that subject which, as you said, you've spent decades now studying and talking about and creating policy around. You've now written a book. So maybe take some time just to talk us through the thinking that you explore in that book. And the byline of the book is what we get wrong about early care and education. And I wonder, what is it in your experience and what you found from your research, what is it that we're getting wrong?
Yeah, so the main title of the book is The Daycare Myth. And so what it explores really is the disconnect between what we know from the science of early development and how that plays out, or in many cases doesn't well play out, in our public policy. And you mentioned kind of early on that, yes, the book is written through a very American lens in terms of its policy examples and reflects a lot of the work that I've been doing here in the U.S., but it's been fascinating as I have had more and more conversation, both in Ireland and the U.K., just how many commonalities I think we find in this space. And the title, the daycare myth, really gets to this idea that, for the better part of 100 years in this country, at least, we have thought about childcare or daycare as being this thing in its own special little bubble, right? That is separate and distinct from education. That we think about young children maybe requiring care, but that slightly older children get involved in learning and education. And we know very definitively at this point that that's just not the case. That not only are children learning from day one, but increasingly we understand the ways and powerful ways that they are beginning to learn in utero. For example, the way that they are beginning to organize their cognition around the rhythms and the patterns of their mother's native language before they even come into the world. And so we know that, that these early years are terrifically important in terms of learning. But there's a, as I mentioned, a disconnect in how we treat those settings for young children that, you know, here in the U.S., and I know, you know, I've had lots of conversations about some similarities here in the U.K., that, you know, a lot of our policy, for example, is focused around the workforce participation, the employment of parents, more so than those programs are, you know, kind of fundamentally focused around optimizing the development of young children. Now, you know, the employment of parents is obviously an important policy goal unto itself, so not one to be criticized. But I, you know, I think the message of the book is that it is time that we learn to walk and chew gum at the same time, right? That we can prioritize, you know, the employment and the, you know, the financial stability of families, while also really paying careful attention to the early development of kids. And you know, not only that, it is important to focus on that from you know, kind of an individual developmental perspective, but that it's important to all of us, whether we have young children in our lives or not. You know, as taxpayers, the book makes the case that, you know, here in the U.S. in particular, that we are, you know, saddling taxpayers sort of endlessly for, you know, decades to come, and seemingly more content to pay for the results of our failure to get things right in the first place, right? More incarceration and more reliance on social services and poor outcomes in our education system, for example. You know, paying those long-term costs rather than, you know, investing proactively and working on getting things right for kids in the first place.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I almost feel like, it's funny, I was only chatting to my wife about this the other day. It almost feels like, particularly when you're looking at older kids, school-age kids, that if you think about it as a bit of a bell curve, the ones that are either really, really clever or the ones that maybe need some extra support and help are just ones getting left behind. And we seem to think that it's okay to be average. That seems to become a bit of a societal thing. Churning out more average people is better than looking after the ones that aren't quite with us or the ones that are trying to run away because they're so good. Yeah, it was just something that struck me.
No, I'd like to jump in on that as well. I think that's definitely something that's bothered me for a while, is that we seem to have this illusion, myth, to use Dan, for want of a better word, in what we see as achievement with children of certain ages. And it is very academic. We know it's important to achieve. But I think there's so much more to development. And that's what struck me so much with Dan, particularly the videos and the detailed explanation. For anybody that hasn't seen it, go and check out the videos that Dan posts on social media, because it will show you that, particularly that younger age, the child, how they're reacting and interacting and the start of conversation and how their emotions, you can see it developing by how they interact with their caregiver, whoever that caregiver is. And I think that's the bit that we miss, that sometimes we're too quick to want to get to number recognition and shapes and colours, and we're looking to push towards school because we get caught in that funnel of school as education rather than life as education. And it depends on where you see education or the importance of it at different stages. And that's what, from the very beginning, struck me from Dan, especially when small children, and it's the way they look at you, and the way they interact and everything that you can see firing off from behind the eyes that we miss sometimes, particularly if we are distracted. And we know that parents are busy, and this is not criticism. People have to work, we have to provide for our families, and we're looking for that long period of time to engage with children. And again, what Dan's been able to do from my point of view is break it down to smaller chunks of quality time, and then you find the time to do other stuff. So they're constantly learning from us, and it's not just school. And I think that that's a bit of a culture shift that I've seen in the last few years. I think we're starting to understand that a little bit more. Would you agree with that, Dan?
Absolutely would. And you know, Scott, I think you hit something really important right on the head, too. Just sort of harking back to my own days as a kindergarten teacher, a teacher of five-year-olds, you know, years, decades ago now, which is that, you know, I think if you were to ask teachers of young children, you know, what do you value most, you might find that their answers are very different from the, you know, the answers that if you just sort of randomly ask people walking down the street what's important for young children as they enter into school. I, you know, I would venture the guess that if you you know, just asked people at random, you know, what does a 5-year-old need going into school, that they might, you know, echo some of those things that you mentioned, you know, that they can count to a, you know, to count to 20 or identify the letters of the alphabet, for example. Whereas a lot of that, you know, basic academic information, I think teachers find relatively easy to impart when children have, for example, you know, secure attachments with their caregivers, and they have developed social emotional skills and have the ability to interact with their peers and to share and to, you know, to listen, to follow directions. And so, you know, I think sometimes we're off base in our, you know, kind of over focus on some of that academic information.
I think because we're milestone driven, aren't we? I think we are as parents. I think it's, and it's, there is the guidance of your child should do this at this stage, or this is what we would anticipate by 6 months, 8 months, 18 months, 2 years. And we do become a little bit focused. And I think that sometimes the pressure is sometimes put onto the child in they've got to get there, rather than there's all these different markers that we have to hit. They will hit different ones at different times to their peers. And I think that sometimes that institutionalized pitting them against each other, like we do with gradings and schools and exams, we start that very early by doing the same sort of thing with milestones, I think.
We do. And I think, you know, one of the great lessons, hopefully, of some of what I've shared on social media, even, you know, even before young children are actually, you know, in school more formally, is that, you know, those developmental milestones are important to keep track of, but that there's an incredibly large sort of range of what is considered normal, right? That, you know, that there are children who begin walking at 7 and 8 months, and there are children that, you know, don't begin walking until 18 months or later. And, you know, the same thing goes with language development. And so I think, you know, there can be a danger in kind of overly ascribing importance to some of those developmental milestones without recognizing that, you know, that broad range of normal, and that, you know, children on an individual basis sort of develop on their own individual timelines.
Yeah. Okay. So I've got a double part question. So we'll go with the first part and then I'll come in with the second part. So then you talked about the bit that we're getting wrong as such, and that's obviously the emphasis of the book. So what can parents do to break that cycle? And can they do that without intervention? Can the parents start to break that cycle on their own?
Yeah, they absolutely can. And you know, I think the message in the book to parents, the book is actually written kind of with three separate audiences in mind, right? Both for parents, for policymakers, and for professionals who are working in this early years field. And so, you know, I think an important message to all three of those groups, but particularly for parents, is just around the importance of these earliest years. You know, I mentioned in the opening when Scott asked about sort of defining what, you know, how we define early childhood. Yes, you know, we look as a field at birth to eight, but boy, the first, you know, 3 years of development, and in particular, frankly, the first year of development is so important, because it is where so much of the wiring of the brain sort of metaphorically occurs. And so, you know, one of the great lessons, I hope, for parents in this book is that the choice of you know, how to spend your child's you know, earliest months and years of life is a really terrific importance and something to plan ahead for as much as you can. Not every pregnancy, for example, is planned, but many are, and it's important to, you know, to give thought in advance as much as we can to, you know, what are the experiences that your child will be having during those years, and who's going to provide those experiences are really important. I think, you know, the if there's one message for parents, it is that, you know, selecting who and you know, with whom and how your child will spend those earliest months and years is really not a matter of choosing a babysitter, for example. That what you are choosing is, who are the adults who will literally co-construct your child's brain. And that's a, you know, that's a very different proposition from, you know, with whom can I leave my child for 8 hours and know that they'll be safe and fed while, you know, while I go off to work. And so whether that's making accommodations to, you know, make sure that, that you know, a parent is able to stay home with a newborn, or selecting a program outside of the home, you know, the choice of who's going to do that is really awfully important.
Quick question, just on a similar theme, and I, in the past 3 weeks, I've probably read this line in various places that we should be curious, not judgmental. However, I find it really hard. There are so many parents now, seemingly, you see so many small children in buggies with a phone or an iPad. You go on a plane or on a train, and rather than a parent maybe sitting reading a book or, you know, sticking stickers on the window or just having a chat, there's an iPad and the headphones and the kids absorbed in the iPad. What are your thoughts on that? Is that damaging our children, or is it giving us an opportunity to bring them new ways of learning that perhaps we just didn't have, as certainly I didn't have as a parent. I don't think any of us probably did. Is it good? I don't know. What are your thoughts, Dan?
Yeah, it's a great question, Scott. And I take a very pragmatic approach to this question. I think it's, you know, it's easy to talk about this in sort of all or nothing terms. And, you know, realistically, I think at this point in our human history, you know, the idea of, you know, the idea that young children will never be exposed to a screen is probably not a terribly realistic one for most families. And so, you know, I think it's smart use, and its use in moderation is as important as anything else. But, you know, that said, I think we've got good reason to believe that, you know, extensive screen use for young children is really not beneficial to them. In fact, maybe very much the opposite. Importantly, though, I think, you know, one thing that we don't talk enough about in this space is the influence of adults owned screen use. That there's, you know, there's fascinating research that suggests, you know, that for every you know, every minute that parents are preoccupied by screens, that, you know, that their verbal interaction, for example, with their young children, you know, decreases significantly. And so it's not just a matter of, you know, not putting a screen in front of your baby, but not, you know, during those years, putting a screen in front of yourself, in a lot of cases, that it limits that important one-on-one interaction that needs to happen between parents or, you know, other significant caregivers and kids.
Thanks, Dan. I love that different perspective. Brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd have to say that's a brilliant answer, Dan. And I think it's individualized to a point, and there is a balance. You know, and one thing that we discuss quite a lot is, there is a time and a place for it. There's obviously age appropriate. It's not going anywhere. I think sometimes when we try to restrict it, we might be hindering them in a certain way. Like when we look at social media with children as they get a little bit older, if they can use it effectively, it becomes an asset to put on a CV going forward, because most industries they might go into are going to use social media. So if we can use it the best way and understand it, the bit that's getting a little bit better, I think, particularly on social media, is that we're starting to see a little bit behind the curtain. So you've seen a little bit more posts of people that show the perfect corner of a room, and then they show the camera over the washing on the other side, because that's the bit that we didn't normally see. So I think it's quite good. Or you will see influencers now that are getting a little bit better at, they will show the picture of themselves looking nice and lean and ripped or whatever it might be, and then they'll show you how they looked 5 minutes before they got that light and then that pose correct. And I think that if we get that bit better, I think for children of all ages, then we can see that it's not this tool that we can beat ourselves with. But I agree. I think that there is a balance. And one thing that we do know is, if you look at neurodiversity, for an example, is that sometimes that screen becomes an escape from the world that is becoming too overwhelming at that period. So we can use it again as a tool. For example, my boys that have got autism of all ages, as the world becomes a little bit too much and you can feel them getting overwhelmed, if they're wearing a hoodie, the hoodie goes up and it comes right down. The headphones go in and the screen comes out, and it's like, just give me 10 minutes to reset and then I'm yours and I'll come back. The problem is managing that 10 minutes. So again, I agree with you. I think it's things in moderation, but it does help. And I've worked with families that children are struggling to interact in a certain way. They might be dyslexic. We might not know they're dyslexic yet, and trying to interact in the way that we teach, that watching it visualized on a screen, they might pick it up differently. So it's again, it's using it to its benefits, because there is good apps on these tablets and on phones that they can use to learn. But again, but then it does worry me. I'm not sitting here saying I think it's great. With teenage boys in particular, I know that this screen time is something that we've got to manage, but I think it's something that we find that balance, which is everything. But parenting, as they say, like, you can only do it going forward, but it only makes sense in reverse, you know. So as we sort of look back on it, oh, maybe I should have done that differently, you're past it. And the last thing before we move on to the next question, that I agree with, is I think that it's the parenting screen time that I think we're very quick to say you're spending too much time on that screen while we're on our screen, or we're watching Netflix and we're not engaging. And I do it. I'm not going to sit here and say I don't. My boys will ask me a question. Scott, I'm sure you're the same. And I'll be doing the email and I'm answering them, but I'm not really paying attention to what they're asking me. And then all I catch is, as they start to walk off, it doesn't matter, Dad. You know, and it's like you're trying to engage in two things, which I know they say men can't multitask, but I really can't. So I need to focus on what I'm doing. So it does set the wrong example sometimes. We're telling them not to do something that we're doing. Scott, I'm sure you could agree with that as a working dad as well.
Look, I love it when somebody holds up a mirror and just and gives you something new and different to think about. And that'll be in my head now for a couple of weeks, just thinking about that, about how I manage my screen time. I used to put parental controls on my own phone 2 Christmases ago, and it switches off at 10 at night. It's because I got into that habit of just picking it up for absolutely no reason. It wasn't even making a noise. I was just in the habit of picking it up. So I stopped. And I put parental controls on my own phone for 2 years. So yeah.
Well, I think it's especially important with the very youngest children. And so I, you know, even in the social media content that I post, I try to steer away from absolutes. Although I would say, you know, babies don't need screens in their lives. Right. At all. Right. We have centuries upon centuries of history before screens existed. Babies need, you know, engaged interactions, one-on-one, face-to-face with, you know, stable, nurturing caregivers. That said, you know, I think there are instances where parents and caregivers may need, you know, we all need occasionally to take a shower, right? Or to use the bathroom, or, to take a phone call. And so, you know, speaking in absolutes about, you know, there never being a reason that young children should be exposed to it, I think leads to a lot of parental guilt. And so, you know, I try to steer away from those absolutes. But I don't know if you saw, Scott, there was a post that I shared on social media here recently about a fascinating study that sort of used both screen time data and audio recordings of interactions between, in this case, mothers and their babies. You know, that I was mentioning that, you know, what they found was that when mothers were sort of actively engaged with screens, there was this significant drop off in their verbal interactions with their children. What was most fascinating maybe about that study was that out of these 12-hour periods that were studied, more than 4 hours on average, they found the adults were actively engaged with screens. And so, you know, roughly a third of their waking time, even in the presence of their infants in this case, was spent actively engaged with a cell phone or a computer screen or a TV screen. And so that's where, you know, while I don't think we need to speak in absolutes, I do think it's important that we can be very mindful of how easily engaged we as adults can become in that screen time, and you know, certainly look at opportunities to pare that back a bit, so that we're not talking about a third of our waking hours being engaged with a screen in the presence of a baby.
I'm actually going to skip forward a question and go back then, because you've just led quite nicely. So one practical thing that parents listening could do to improve the development of their children during early years, would that be it? Or have you got another golden nugget for us?
Well, I think that's a really important one. I think, to recognize the book lays out and is sort of framed around what I call the three simple truths of early development. And these are not, earth-shattering original ideas on my part. They're sort of my effort to summarize several decades worth of early development research. But those are, that learning begins in utero and never stops, that the period from prenatal to three is this uniquely consequential window during which the fundamental architecture of the brain is wired, and that the optimizing that early brain development is very much dependent on stable, nurturing, one-on-one relationships with really highly engaged adults. And so, again, just sort of harkening back to this idea of who is that highly engaged adult going to be, or who are the set of highly engaged adults, I think is really important. Know, for example, that, that young children learn less about language from screens than they do from looking, up close at you, having those face-to-face interactions with your baby. I've written a lot on social media about the observational powers of babies, that they are sort of innately wired to seek out and identify the faces that are important in their lives. And they're very closely attuned, for example, to our mouths, right? That they, they're not just listening to language, they're watching carefully the shape of our mouths and how our lips and our faces move to make the sounds that eventually become language. And so, prioritizing those one-on-one face-to-face interactions, you'll never go wrong with a baby.
Brilliant tip. And I'm sort of at that stage with my granddaughter at the moment, who's 6.5 months old, where everything is being felt. So when you've got her up close, it's the hand pulling the bottom lip, it's the ears, it's the cheek, it's the glasses getting pulled off your face. So when they are up, so you're right, that experimenting different parts and that language you've mentioned, she's very much a daddy's girl. So we're getting the da-da-da-da-da-da-da at them. So everybody is da-da-da-da-da at the moment. So yeah, everything you've just said, it's really interesting, because in the almost 6 months since we've connected, I've been able to follow it through a different lens, which you mentioned, which is through the eyes of a grandparent, which does give you a little bit more disconnect, if that's the right word, and you can look at it a little bit differently. And it's nice to see that sort of interaction. But you're right, that face-to-face is so important. So
absolutely.
Going back to the myth then, and the bits that you think we've maybe got wrong, and looking at that correction, how much of that correction is from government level to sort of make that change? How much of this is driven by policy as opposed to parents, or how much of it is a collaborative?
Well, I do think it's a collaborative. And I think, as we've been talking about, there are important lessons for parents in the book. There are important lessons for, early childhood professionals, teachers that are working with children, like those, kind of the importance of those face-to-face interactions. But there are also, very important pieces of this that really relate to our public policy. We could take that very example of the importance of, one-on-one kind of face-to-face interaction, and apply that then to, how we train, how we respect, how we compensate the people who work in the early childhood field, how we regulate those programs. For example, one temptation that I, have seen time and again here over the past couple of years here in the U.S. is to say, the childcare industry is really in crisis financially, and so you know, one of the common kind of refrains coming from policymakers is that we just regulate it too much, that we need to strip away any sort of requirements that aren't related to the basic health and safety of young children. And I think when you think about those three simple truths of development that I shared, you recognize that there's much more than just basic health and safety happening in these classrooms. And so, you know, from a policy perspective, we are seeing lots of states around America seeking to deregulate things like ratios, like the number of children that can be served by an individual teacher, right? To say, maybe if we allowed programs to have just one or two more babies, in their care in their classrooms, then that would help to improve the financial situation of these programs, which may very well be true from a financial standpoint. But for each of us as dads, we know how overwhelming, even having a single infant it can be, and then we think about, gosh, how overwhelming must it be to have quadruplets, for example, right? Obviously, just a small number of parents, have that happen situationally, but that's very much the norm. In fact, it's sort of, at least in this country, the gold standard when it comes to our early childhood programs, right? That you're in a very high quality program if the ratio of adults to infants is 1-4. Right, which is sort of the equivalent of trying to parent quadruplet newborns. And so that our policymakers would be saying, what if we deregulated in a way that would allow 6 babies per individual? It's not hard to see how we that sort of policy decision then plays out in the development of those individual kids. How much less individual attention they get, how much less FaceTime and language development, and all of those important things that they get. And so the book is very much premised on the idea that we need transformational sorts of investments in young children and families, but also I think Scott from from reading the book that points out the ways that we are frankly already paying for the system that we need. We're just doing it in all the wrong ways, right? That we're as I mentioned earlier, seemingly content to pay for interactions with the criminal justice system or poor health outcomes or more reliance on social services. All of these things shown to be mitigated by investments in high quality early childhood programs.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you very much, Dan. Before Scott starts to wind us up and lead us out, I'm going to ask you both a question, and I'll come to Dan first as our expert on the day. If you could give advice to yourself as a first-time dad of one thing you wish you knew then that you know now, what would it be? And then Scott, same to you.
Yeah, no, it's such a good question, and I part of the reason that I love the work that I'm doing now and sharing some of these lessons, Scott, is that, truth told, I didn't know these things well as a first-time parent. And one of the messages that I'm always trying to spread is that every first-time parent is just that, right? Whether you're a pediatrician or, in my case, I had a graduate degree in early childhood education, as did my wife. We both met when we were teaching kindergarten in the public schools. So, you couldn't ask for a more, early childhood focused couple to bring children into the world. But no question, we were better equipped to teach 5-year-olds to read than we were to bring a new infant home for the first time. And so I think, one lesson for new parents is just to give yourself a lot of grace, right? That everyone is new at this, but that there is knowledge out there that can really help to, to make the situation better. And so a lot of my work now is very much the sharing of these, you know, developmental learnings that are, you know, available through the research that, gosh, I wish I had known as a first time parent.
Thanks, Dan. Scott.
So it's always interesting when you get to go second, because, you know, you're going straight after the world expert in the subject, but you do have, but you do have 2 minutes to think about the answer. And the answer I was thinking about was this, and it was actually something that came up at an event I was at for kids last week. Meet your kids where they are, not where you want them to be. And I wish I'd known that as my kids were younger, because I think you always want better for your kids. You always want them to do a bit more. You always want them to go and try a new camp or do a new thing or stop doing this or start doing that. And you're almost kind of projecting your needs onto them. I'm almost projecting my needs onto my kids. And I think that that whole idea of letting them find their own way, albeit with maybe the odd nudge here and there to keep them kind of on the straight and narrow, is fine. But that idea of meeting them where they are, not where you want them to be, I heard that and I just went, oh my God. Little light bulb came on the top of my head and I went, Jesus, that's the thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's very wise.
No one's ever said that to me before, Dan. You're the first person to ever say that to me. That's very wise.
Oh, come on, Scott.
I will leave it there.
I look wise, but I might not again. So listen, Scott has said a few times, Dan on social media this and Dan on social media that. If people want to hear more of what you're saying, and we've spoken a little bit about YouTube as well, and I know you do a good bit on there. Where do they go? What's the best place to go and get all your links?
Yeah, probably the best place to go to get all of my links is my author website, which is just literally my name, Dan Worry, WUORI.com. And there are links to all of my social media platforms there. But I am sharing these child development lessons, frequently with short video clip examples every day on X, on LinkedIn, on Threads, on Blue Sky now, and on Facebook. And so no matter where you are social media wise, chances are good that you'll be able to find it. And if you just look up my name on any of those platforms, you should be able to find those posts.
Brilliant stuff, Dan. Listen, as a podcast host, but probably more as a parent, I have absolutely loved the conversations that we've been having. I'm looking forward to hopefully seeing you when you come to Dublin in the coming months. But for now, thank you so much for joining us. I've really enjoyed the chat.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for the invitation. I am looking forward, and maybe that's a good place to close, which is that I will be over in your part of the world in early 2025, from mid-February until early March in Ireland and Scotland, and then beginning sort of mid-March, we'll be traveling around England and Wales and down to Jersey as well. So, 5-6 weeks that I'll be, traveling and speaking and sharing these messages very exclusively. So looking forward to seeing you both while I'm there.
Great stuff. Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan. Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more information on IPIP, the work we do and the services we offer, please visit www.ipip.co.uk.